try to launch a discussion. And since I am the I have to chair the session at the same time, we will have all the afternoon to do the discussion. So be ready to for that, okay? So first, just a few words about myself, because many people ask me where I'm coming and where is Nice. So just a few words. So I'm coming from the Laboratoire Lagrange. Actually, I am the director of the laboratory. Laboratoire Lagrange is part of the Observatoire de la Côte d'Azur, and Observatoire de la Côte d'Azur is part of the University Côte d'Azur. So here, in France, Paris, you have Monaco here, but Nice is not very far from Monaco. So we are here. And this is just a nice overview of the observatory on the Mont Gros. So you have a big dome and Nice City. Inside the dome, you can see these refracting telescopes, and the dome was built by Eiffel, the same guy who built the Eiffel Tower. And this is the university in Nice, a nice place also. And we have also a building for us in the university that is brand new, that it was built in February this year. So since we may have some postdoc position, some doc position, please, if you are interested to come, just send me an email and we will try to see. Okay. That was the message of the director. Okay, stellar wind. Just to mention that if you type stellar wind, you know, on the web, you will see that the first thing that you find from Google is that stellar wind is a code name of the information collected under the President Surveillance Program. So I don't know if you are aware of that, but it means that maybe at the CIA they have some spies or that are doing astronomers or astrophysics. So take care when you are sending emails with stellar wind keywords. It may be, you know, strange to people maybe listening to you. And then before launching the conference, I want just to mention and to thank the local organizing committee for organizing this very nice, you know, advertisement and not advertisement, what, afternoon. So you see here a bow shock. So that was very nice, and I really want to thank Pierre. Pierre, thanks, and all the luck for all the things you have done for us. Really, we really appreciate that. Okay, now coming to science. Just to, I will have list many questions, some provocative, some stupid questions. So we will have to maybe to skip some of them, or if you want to answer. So the first one that came to me is, do we know the global picture for all types of winds, and what is missing? I mean, for me, sometimes it looks like we really understand the global picture of AGB or massive stars, and we are just looking at very narrow and small details. Is it true or not? Or saying in another way, in which direction what we are planning to do in the 4 or 5 next year that are coming, in which direction you think it's better to go? So we want to to start first. Don't be shy. Yeah, you can. Maybe with the microphone it will be better. You want to think. Is someone else is ready? Yeah? Okay.
Hi. So I don't have so much experience, but that's only my impression from my field and from also talks I've heard about other fields. We are concerned about details, that's clear. Each of us is concerned about another detail. But I do have the impression that the impact of all these details can lead to very significant global results. In the field that I'm working on, Wolf-rayet stars, I do not have the impression that we understand what binarity does, for example. So even though we are focused on details, this is my impression.
So maybe for this kind of objects, maybe it's not just a detail. I mean, the big question is, are Wolf-rayet stars really binaries, coming from binaries or from single stars? This is a main issue, I guess, no?
Yeah, is the fundamental question. Yeah. But eventually what we do to explore this question would be usually detailed studies of detailed systems. And so in this sense, detail.
Okay, another point here.
So I'm doing stellar evolution, not winds. But the two is obviously connected. So what is would be really important for me from you guys is to provide the Maslow's rate recipes, the parametrization that we can rely our simulations on. And this is what only you can provide, because I cannot figure it out on my own, which parametrization to use, how the Maslow's depends on the different stellar parameters. That has to come from observations. So I would like to make a call for all of you to, every time you observe something and every time you publish a Maslow's rate, try to parameterize it so we could use it in our simulations.
Just to comment, but maybe this also this Maslow's depend on the line on the wavelength that you are observing. I mean, there is many Maslow's estimation. If you go from the UV to the infrared to the X-rays, you will find different Maslow's. So what is the real Maslow's? Okay.
Well, maybe directly to that.
You please, yes, you have a microphone then.
Hello, can you hear me?
And then here,
hello,
Johan and you.
Yeah, so I think for the TPAGB, we're like in Uppsala, we're trying to do these Maslow's prescriptions. But I think the current conclusion or where we are at right now is that there simply isn't such a simple correlation between the Maslow's rate and stellar parameters that will hold over time, at least. So maybe you can do it for a little bit, and then you need something else, and then you need something else for the star when the star evolves. And I would definitely say concerning the AGB winds is that I think we have a pretty good idea of what's happening on the TPAGB, but we, at least my impression is that we're pretty clueless on what's happening towards the end, the very end.
And then
okay. So coming back to the winds itself, I would say at least. So the first answer to this question, when you have this, do we know the global picture? Might be yes, but as soon as you think a moment longer, it's actually no, because we know that the hot stars are radiatively driven, and while this was unclear for the Wolf-Rayet stars for a while, if it was only radiative driving because they have these higher mass loss rates compared to the O stars, we are pretty sure that this is the case, and it's just a question of that you require complex enough modeling to reproduce this. And we know that for the cool stars, it's dust-driven, but as soon as it goes into the details of it, this picture is not really clear, and we don't really know the exact wind driving. And I cannot speak for the cool star community, but in the hot star community, there's all kinds of details that are unsure, like what is the important point that sets the mass loss rate? How important is the influence of turbulence? For O stars, we have some idea how to measure that. For Wolf-Rayet stars, we actually have no idea how to measure that. And so there are things that might seem to be details at first. But if you want the mass loss rate and then go to the evolutionary tracks, they can have a great influence. So even if we know the general picture and might write textbooks about it, it might still be that in 50 years, if we make some improvements, this whole picture changes, and we made some kind of terrible mistakes or approximations that we better should not have. So I think there is definitely stuff missing, and a part of that is things we cannot measure. But the other part is, of course, lacking computational power. And so in the hot star regime, you can, for example, as we've seen also at this meeting, you can either do detailed radiative transfer and very simple hydrodynamics, or you can do detailed hydrodynamics with relatively simple radiative transfer. You cannot really do both. It's just not possible currently. And everybody's maybe dreaming of eventually the big one model that explains it all, but I don't think we'll have in the next decade or even in the next two or three decades.
Mm. Okay. Yours?
Yep. Yeah, just a philosophical point. Well, not philosophical, but the point was made that we need observations to have recipes for stellar evolution. Well, we need observations to test theory, but ultimately for stellar evolution, you want to rely on theory. Because, well, there are a couple of reasons for this. One is, often you need to make an extra step between a theoretical model and an observation, and then you have uncertain stellar parameters that then enter the stellar evolution. Things can go horribly wrong if you rely on observational relationships. The other point is, if you have a theoretical model, then you know how it depends on all the individual stellar parameters. If you do observational relationships, what very often happens is that people extrapolate those and go into the wrong parameter range, and if you have an empirical relationship, it goes terribly wrong. So, just a philosophical point. And at this point, we only have a theoretical recipe for main sequence massive stars. But all other massive stars, evolved LBVs, Poincarés, etc., we don't have that yet, and the same, of course, for the low mass stars.
You want to comment also?
I can continue on the points made by Jorik. Indeed, when you look, and I have here plot on my screen, it's one of the famous plots made by Jacob van Loon. And there he has compared different mass loss rate prescriptions for supergiants. And in some regimes, they differ by more than two orders of magnitudes. And they're all, you know, similar, and the one has slightly different range for luminosity, and the other one for effective temperature. And if you then go to most of these recipes are then often based on dust diagnostics, convert that to a gas mass loss rate, then you add another point of uncertainty. And if you then compare, you know, people who have done the results of studies who have done that, you see trends. But if we plot on top of these trends, two of the most famous red supergiants, Betelgeuse and VY Canis Majoris, they are off hugely from these trends. So we do not understand these two stars, let alone that we can believe, oh no, there is some, I think we can, the trend in it, the relative trends might be more or less fine, but the scaling can be off, and this should be taken into account in the stellar evolution models and in the uncertainties from the things we wish to predict.
Okay, thanks. Other comments? If not, I will move on a little bit to another point. Yes, it was something that I was, it was not totally clear. Because I'm not from this field, in fact, so do IGB and post-IGB and planetary nebulas share the same physics? I mean, is it possible to have the same code to, you know, to model this type of object? It was not really clear to me. So, no, they said no. Someone want to discuss? Yeah. No, you don't want? Yeah.
Oh no, of course not. AGBs and post-AGBs. Okay, I will just set AGB and planetary nebulae. Post-AGB are something in the middle that I personally don't understand. But of course not. Planetary nebulas are also driven the expansion of the envelope by ionization, the ionization front. And you also have a fast wind that is creating this curve, and also a lot of planetary nebulae exhibit X-ray emission, so they're definitely not the same. I don't know what else to say.
Okay, so the point also, if I'm not wrong, the big question is that we don't understand why planetary nebulae are so, you know, asymmetrics or dissymmetrics or with jets, whereas the AGB phase is quite symmetrical. So if we don't have something that can go from the AGB to post-AGB to planetary nebulae, I mean, I think it would be hard, no, to be sure that we understand everything, no?
Well, there are mechanisms, yeah. But the thing is that we cannot point down to a single mechanism that provides all the shapes. So I think probably the question should move towards saying that, well, there might be different mechanisms to reproduce all the physical structures that we see. And sometimes one is more important than the other. And we have seen on Monday, too, that you show that AGB stars are not symmetric anymore. Yeah. I mean, we have seen the last talk also showing that really AGB mass loss is not spherical in the cases where we can resolve it. And so maybe we have to change the picture there, that the asymmetry is produced in the post-AGB phase. Mm-hmm. This is the most common belief right now. the asymmetry might be produced early on. And going back a little bit to what towards the winds, in most cases we are, the modeling of the winds involves single stellar scenarios, while we are seeing that in most cases we see where the asymmetries are involved and we are dealing with binary systems. And the binary itself, as you show, has a lot of influence on the mass loss process. So I think there is more physics. Of course, there is always more physics to include in the models, but I think we are getting to the point where we understand a little bit better what's going on. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Again, I'm not an expert, but there were not many talks about magnetic field, for instance, because it's quite complicated, I know. But do you think that maybe this is something that is missing in the modeling or not? Do we have to go in this direction or do you think it's useless?
I think magnetic fields are like dragons. We don't know how they behave, but we don't know. I mean, we know that they have fire. I mean, whenever you don't understand something, you put a magnetic field in there and it works.
Or a binary. No.
Well, but binary, we see binaries. I mean, there are less detections of magnetic fields.
No,
and I'm not saying that they are not important. They are there. Mm-hmm. They are there. I mean, but they are hard to measure and hard to model in many cases. I mean, I'm not saying that it's not, they are not necessary. I mean, we know that we cannot explain the sun without a magnetic field, mm-hmm. for example. Yeah. And it's the closest example we have, so.
You want to comment, yeah?
Correct me if I'm wrong. Magnetic fields have not been detected in actual evolved planetary nebulae, just protoplanetary nebulae. No? Am I wrong? So that also, we still don't know if the magnetic field is sink into the star or is in from the interstellar medium.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Somebody else want to add something? Comment? No, if not, I will move. I don't remember what I've written myself. Okay, in which direction should we better push? So we are more or less tackle this question, but yes, you mentioned that maybe it's we have to go in the modeling direction. So do you think that it's really in this direction that we need some new stuff or for the modeler? No? No idea or it's a bad question?
I think we have no choice in the sense that there are new telescopes that are, ALMA is going to do incredible.
I have it in my slides, okay.
I mean, observations are going to revolutionize everything, so modelers will have to follow whatever is seen, so
okay.
I think.
So the next question would be maybe more provocative. Yes.
I was just going to say that we need models and we need observations, but we also need to have statistics. So, you know, you never know if you've got the most extreme object that's just the weird one because, I don't know, it's got a disk or something. You need statistics, and you need statistics in different parameter spaces. So you need statistics about binaries, you need statistics of low metallicity, you need statistics of time mass, you need statistics in different environments to actually understand this problem and how the dependencies interlink.
Yeah, okay, but if you mean statistics observationally, you mean data,
yeah.
The problem is that for massive stars, the statistic is not very large.
Yeah.
I mean.
So you need to go further afield.
Yeah. So. No reaction? Yes, no, it's kind of, you know, a joke, but I'm really myself convinced that more and more we observe and the more we found binaries everywhere. So really, it's a real question. I mean, is it useful, to make models for single stars, for instance, or do we really have to take the binarity effect into account for all these winds? So I want to have your point of view. Maybe you want to comment? You would say no, no way.
I mean, we definitely have to care about binaries, but I'm definitely biased, so probably the worst person to answer the question. I think we do have to care about single stars. If I go off to my bias way, because even single stars can be coming from binaries, but
yeah, that's what you said.
So,
yeah.
But even for understanding the binaries, we need to understand the stars themselves. So we do need to have good models of single stars. Regardless, we need to know the physics of each star in the binary in order to figure out how the two interact with each other. So we need to understand them both.
Sure, but binary is not just two single stars. So
but they have to be done together. It's a highly coupled problem, and that's very, very challenging computationally and understanding the physics. So I think we have to definitely care about them. That's my
Yorick?
Yeah, you need both, clearly. A lot of massive stars are in binaries. Just talking about massive stars, no idea about AGB stars. But for massive stars, it's measured that a third of all massive stars is a radial velocity variable. That's in the largest sample in the VFTS survey. So that means about half of the massive stars are in binaries. And that means that some of them will not be important for stellar evolution because they're too far away. But on the other hand, there are single stars that have a binary past. If you take all that into account, you come to about a half. So you need to you need to understand stellar evolution, both binary evolution and single star evolution. And then, of course, for binary evolution, you still also need to understand the single stars. So you need both. You get large samples now for massive stars with multi-object fibers like flames and so on. So we do get larger samples now. But that is maybe harder to do for AGB stars because they're probably more distributed. So maybe MUSE will help you.
Okay. Yeah, you want to? Please. Use
I mean, for the lower mass stars, maybe a stellar mass companion is not so important, but they will have other companions, planets, and things like that. And then we're always talking about multiples. And the ones that do interesting things are typically the binaries or the multiple component systems. If you think that single stars are not interesting,
this is provocative. Yes. Other comments? Let's move on. This is just my point. I mean, I heard just from you that we need more statistics, so the answer is no. But really, we are getting in a direction that we have really so many data, I mean, at many wavelengths. So I know a huge database that are never used from all the heritage, you know, observations. So you saw SKA, you know, the presentation about the amount of data that we will have. We will have Gaia very soon. So really, do we need still more data? Or the answer is certainly yes. But in which direction maybe we have to go? Because maybe we can concentrate on some, you know, type of data. I mean, spectroscopy, photometric, or distances, or what do we need? Someone want to? We need everything? Yeah, sure. Okay, yeah.
Okay, of course I would not say that we should stop observations, but referring to the question that you put on the slide, I think one thing that we should keep in mind in the community as a whole is that there has to be funding for people who do modeling. Because typically a lot of positions come together with a new big instrument, a new big telescope, and then you have people for reducing the data and stuff like that. But on the modeling side, it's usually not the same. So people who do models, these are typically small working groups, people who just be there, and if they retire, maybe nobody's there to continue this project. So I think this is a message that we, in general, should try to get out to the institute directors and all the people responsible, that having a proper modeling and also having a good knowledge transfer from one generation to the next in terms of what is needed for modeling, this is something that has to be taken care about. And it's something that is not as easy to sell to the public as pretty pictures and stuff like that. What you get, at least from some of the telescopes, where you get a lot of nice pictures that you can sell. But the modeling is the hard science that tries to explain it. And we should just make sure that we don't lose knowledge here and really preserve what we have and and maybe try to build a better basis for it.
Mm. I agree, yeah. Even if it's difficult to have someone in the lab that knows, you know, hydro, radiative transfer, and etc.
Exactly, and on top of this, that most of us of the people who are doing this are not even people who code because they have studied computer science.
Mm-hmm.
They are physicists who just learned that on the fly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Other comments? Yeah, on the back.
Okay, so I think to some point you cannot go further with modeling because you need more in terms of resolution and sensitivity. And for example, to comment on the uniqueness of models to some stars, you can have several models to explain the star and you cannot tell what is the working one. Okay, so we need higher resolution, higher sensitivity data. So we cannot stop observing.
Yeah. Okay. So thanks. I have some slides about modeling, I guess.
And, sorry.
Oh yeah.
One more comment is that because nowadays we have a lot of high quality data, so for many people. We still have the habit to look at too much in the image and have the conclusion only by looking at the image. So from the analysis point of view, I would like to encourage using more quantifying method in making the analysis in this field.
Okay, you mean not just nice images,
not
but
just
also
looking at the at
spectroscopy
the
and photometry
from and saying that oh this is like this.
Yeah,
like
sure,
that.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, so I have pointed. Do you have enough atomic data? Yeah, I've seen in a presentation that there is more than 180 molecules that were detected. So. I was wondering if because it was presented that if it was everything was running, there were no problems. So for me, it's not clear if we know all the atomic data and if there is some molecules that are particularly non-known or unknown, and we really need some computation for that. So if someone you want to comment or someone want to comment on that, yeah.
I think we really need more data, particularly for the thermodynamic conditions present in the wind. I mean, for temperatures and densities which are not like on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
So.
So you mean computation from quantum mechanic calculations or experiments?
For example, but
yeah.
Also, I mean, there's written atomic data, but I really would also say molecular data because. A molecule is not just only the sum of the atoms.
Yeah, sure. But I think it's not so easy, I mean, to make some quantum calculation
for
complicated molecules.
It's not really easy, but I think, yeah.
And there is some molecules that are missing right now, I mean, for the coming observations?
Yeah. I mean, there are also quite exotic species, radicals, which do not really exist naturally on Earth, but in space, of course.
Yeah, I comply to what David says, and that's why we need to collaborate with the chemists also to get the lab results, for instance, for the chemical reaction rates.
Mm.
For the networks, for instance, that David is running, we should realize that only at room temperature, maybe some 15% of the rates have been measured in labs.
Mm.
All the rest are then from quantum chemical calculations, but if we go then to lower temperatures, we are often based on some kind of an extrapolation, and this can go awfully wrong. And the thing I have discovered is that when I discuss that with my colleagues of chemistry, you know, they often have these instruments that you can use to get these rates out, but they were not interested in astrochemistry, or they did not realize that it can have some astrochemical goal of their instrument. And so if you start talking with people in gas phase chemistry and condensation matter, you know, you can have this nice collaboration, but it takes some time to get used to the vocabulary of each of us. Mm-hmm. But you can do that, and often they are sitting close to us, but we need to put effort in that. Mm-hmm. And also meanwhile ask funding to have some official collaboration between different institutes.
Yeah, I think it's especially crucial because we need to know also atomic data, but non-LTE, you have to use non-LTE physics. So it's even worse. I mean, there is plenty of lines that we don't know under non-LTE effects. What are they are looking?
If you're talking about molecules, the situation is not much better for pure atoms. So as somebody from the HIMARS regime, we are also really needing an extension of atomic data in certain regimes. So for example, when I do radiative driving, I crucially depend on that I have sufficient atomic data for all the elements that I take into account. And the point is, in some cases, there is just data missing. Then you have probably something like the opacity project for iron lines, but it's not existing for any other of the iron group elements, for example. Or you have Bob Kuruch's the stuff that you might even use in the Cool Star regime, but it's suddenly ending at a certain ionization stage, and then there's nothing, and you can just hope that he lives 150 years to make more calculations. So that there are really very, very few guys doing such things, and there is hardly new data coming up. I mean, that makes calculations comparable because we are basically all use the same atomic data, but that doesn't mean that it's complete or that it's true. So I think we would really need more input on that, also on the atomic level.
In this direction, I would say that there is in France, I don't know elsewhere, but collaboration, for instance, with people that are using big lasers, you know, for nuclear fusion. And you can test in this direction some equation states that you have inside stars using these large facilities. So this is something that we can push also. Yeah,
there is a certain stuff that you can do through measurements, but I think especially when you go to the higher atoms, then you have the problem that you cannot measure everything. A lot of stuff is depending on good calculations and approximations to do that.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Okay. Next question. In which direction should the model go? I mean, we have seen many 3D, non-LTE, multi-wavelengths. I mean, what is the most important thing for you? I mean, you wish, okay, we need 3D, non-LTE, and multi-wavelength models, but do you think that it's bit more important to go to 3D or non-LTE effects are the dominant effects, for instance? Someone want to comment on that, or? Yeah.
Dust physics.
Dust physics?
Yes.
Yeah. But you mean just which kind of dust physics? Can you give it?
What do you mean exactly by dust physics?
Yeah.
Gas grain coupling, dust dynamics, and grain dynamics, and the gas dynamics which results from the coupling between gas and dust.
So basically from microphysics from the micro scale to the macro scale, in a one sense, from the gas to the dust. So there is this missing gap. Okay.
You mean the way you go from the gas to the dust to form dust, or the gas to dust interaction, for instance, or?
I mean, the drag forces, for instance, the all dust particles will not react the same to the gas. And we've seen with all gas talk how that could explain very characteristic features. Bram also has talked about the dust decoupling from the gas and having different shapes for the
Bell-Schultz. For instance, you think that maybe something like ambipolar diffusion is something that is important in the modeling?
This is yet another thing, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I haven't checked that.
Yeah. I don't know, too.
But
I've seen some models already using ambipolar diffusion, yeah.
I mean, this coupling is the, at least for the cool stars, is the one of the main mechanisms to launch the winds, but it's also, as Bram and Olga have shown, one way also to shape the interaction, the bow shocks.
Yeah.
I think those are good points, and the coupling between gas and dust is a lot of authors and papers just assume perfect coupling, but I'm not sure if that really happens because it really depends on the dust parameters that you put in. You know, dust grains are not spherical, and we actually don't know what the charging is of grains, and everybody just uses Bruce Drain's models and put in his work functions and believe it's true, but actually we don't know what the photoelectric yields are from dust grains and how they react to radiation. And that's crucial in how gas and dust is coupled in there.
Yeah.
I think we have to be very careful sometimes because not every physics that we put into the problem is going to be very relevant for what we are looking at. And sometimes we don't care, I mean, because it doesn't matter. Not because the physics shouldn't be in the problem, but we cannot put all the physics in every problem right now. Hopefully in the future we can put magnetic fields, binaries, stellar evolution, we can drive the wind, we can have dust and gas, we can put all the molecular species, and we can see how they form and how they evolve. But until we can do that, we have to rely on that some parts of the problem we can simplify them and just care about the parts that we are important for that particular problem, and rely that the other versions of the physics we are using are good enough.
Yeah, but the problem is that 20 years ago, you know, when you are modeling a coal like that, it was okay. So maybe 10 years ago you can have an approximation, but right now we have spatial resolution showing that it's not symmetric, it's objects, it have filaments, so the physics is quite complicated.
I'm not saying that we don't have to complicate the models. I'm saying that sometimes we complicate them in the wrong direction.
Yeah, okay.
That's all.
Yeah, talking about bow shocks, I have found this on the web. So this is a real competition. I don't know who has done that, but it's a co. At Mach 8, yes, and you have the bow show. So yes, really, we have some progression, you know, in the modeling.
But it's grown because the legs are outside of the bow shock.
Okay. Yes, about models, I have seen many models, and maybe I have listed some of them here. I certainly missed some of them. So my point was to discuss what are the models you used and are they freely available? I mean, are you ready to give your codes or do you prefer some collaborations? And it was a big issue because as you said, some people are spending years to build new codes and then sending them away, you know, in the nature is not really maybe the best way to do it. So I want to have your opinion on that, and what do you think? Yeah.
Well, I'm totally in favor of having your code public. The first reason is it's the best way to have bugs found, because nobody writes perfect code, and having more people use it really finds more and more bugs, and it's the best way to have good stuff. Yeah, that's basically it. I think that in the ideal world, I mean, observational data is made available after a certain time and people can double check, do their own analysis, do whatever. And if we want to have solid science, I think we should do the same with codes.
Yeah, but my Yeah, I have done some coding and create my own code. The point is that when you do that, you have to be ready to be available for a huge amount of people, you know, asking why I'm using your code that is not working in my case because I use 20,000 Kelvin stars and it is supposed to work for that, and etc. I mean, it's a lot of time, and I'm not...
It is a lot of time, but yeah. If you do it right, people will use it and will cite you, I mean...
Yes, but I mean, then after that, people ask you, what have you done, you know, of your time? asking to emails to people that try to run my code, so... Yeah,
I would exactly agree with what you said. Yeah. So that's a kind of problem. On the one hand, you want to be as open as you can be, and of course you like it if other people find bugs that you might have been worrying about for years. But if you just do support, there is currently no system that would pay you for that. Mm. And of course, it would be awesome to have something. So in an institute, you usually have people who care about the servers and stuff like that. So I think we would actually need people who get positions for permanent positions for just things like supporting a certain code. And then you could easily couple that with the thing that with the restriction that all this code has to be public. Because then you kind of cannot take away the stuff they did, and you would have somebody who is really doing the support on a long-term level. And I think that would be a good compromise, but I currently don't see that this has been implemented somewhere. Yeah.
What? I mean...
With you, yeah, and then here, and...
First-person experience with Stellar Evolution codes. Yeah. I mean, it's impossible to make it... I mean, okay, Mesa is public, but yet zillions of people work. Essentially, they have one person as a computing engineer who does just that. But for anybody else, it's impossible to do something like that. Making public always changes somebody. It's impossible. Who publishes my papers?
I think we agree. We are saying the same thing.
And then there is another. There is a big problem that I find sometimes with making. It's tricky. You have to write all the documentation again. Mm. It's very tricky. Mm. And to keep track of what people do with the code, that often they use it when they shouldn't use it, in regimes that don't make any sense the moment you make it public. Again, it's all this problem he was saying.
You cannot prevent that if you make a code public that people will abuse it.
Yeah, no, but the problem with this, and I have experiences, then they publish results that are wrong because they use the wrong in the wrong way. And then you are... the responsible one that your code doesn't work properly. I know it didn't happen to me. It happened to colleagues. Unless you have this budget that you can have a host of number of people who help you with this, and we all agree it's absolutely unfeasible, really.
Mm. No, I totally agree with you, actually. So the only thing is I said that if you would have permanent positions for people maintaining a certain code, this would not guarantee that nobody would abuse it, but you at least would have people who can keep track of kind of a master branch of this code and say, okay, send it to me, I will review it and add it to the master repository or something. That's the problem, I guess.
Okay, Pierre, okay, you want to comment?
One unideal solution, but which benefits to many people, is to do a benchmark. So gather several people who work on the same kind of thing and design one test.
Well, this is something that
everybody agrees.
We have done. The problem is that the input data set, sometimes the codes, it's difficult to adapt the input data set to have exactly the same conditions. And I remember that I've participated to code benchmark with CAA in France, you know, and there were maybe three or four codes, and there were three or four outputs different, you know. So, and then what are you doing? So
well, that's how it starts, but you need to work until it converges. Mm. Yeah.
Results, 5-6 different Stellar Evolution code. Yeah, they are trying to do it. Unfortunately, you always have, as you say, the outlier.
Yeah.
And you don't know why they have the outlier and so on. But this is something that is being done, at least.
Because we were talking about measurement with a one-person precision. I'm not sure that the code that we use are with such kind of precision.
Yeah.
So you want to comment then, and after.
Okay, well, what I can say at least for Amuse, as I told you, the aim of Amuse is that you have so many different codes to treat different problems in astrophysics, such as stellar evolution, n-body codes. So in Amuse, we have different codes that are public available, and then it's really easy to compare how they work. So basically, if you're changing one line which code you want to use, then you can just compare and see if they give you more or less the same answer for some problem. So that's good. But the bad thing is that in the case of Amuse, you don't really know how the code works itself. So you don't know what's behind it.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a problem. And well, the other thing is that it would be good if we can just implement new codes that are more updated in Amuse, but some of them are not public available. So that's the other thing.
Yeah. But I would say never use the code as a black box. I mean, yeah, otherwise you will get into trouble. Yeah, sure. Yeah, you want to comment? Yeah.
Yes, people who does star formation and stellar feedback codes, they did this paper last year called Starbench, and there were 12 codes. Even though they have detailed different things, how they work, they tested very basic problems, and they should converge to the same, even though they are different numerically, I don't know, axisymmetric, everything, they should convert to the same solutions, even though there must be differences.
Yeah, yeah, agree. Yeah, sure. Yeah, you want to add something?
Maybe there is also the possibility of a compromise, because I have the impression that if a code is completely unavailable and not public and not invisible, then the community kind of has less trust in it, because there are only only a very limited number of people who knows exactly what's going on. Maybe it's also possible to make the code visible in the sense that it's just available somewhere, but that actual usage of it, unless there is exact permission by the developers, is not. I'm not aware of this model, but I think it would be a fair compromise. Mm. Compromise.
This is something that we have tried to done for radiative transfer codes. In fact, we try to make them available and with a short description of what are the inputs, the outputs, and what is the physics inside. So,
maybe a good compromise could be web interfaces. So just make the results kind of available, but not the entire code.
Yeah.
So you can test and look for what you need, but it's not really that everybody can freely use the code. You have just a limited number of options.
Right, yeah. Okay, I want now to move to more about observation and instruments. The first question was, are the current instruments like the available spectrograph, photometers, what you have on the VLT, gravity, sphere, Gaia, sufficient? Or do we need more? I have had these three. And sensitivity. Someone said we need everything, of course, but in which direction you think it's better to go? Someone want to say something about that? Yeah, Willem?
So the biased view of on the VLTI is that what we see in the evolution of the number of proposals, given first with MIDI, Amber, now with Pioneer, and with Gravity, and future with Matisse. So if you look at MIDI, Amber, the evolution there, Amber having a high resolution mode, high spectral resolution mode of 12,000, intermediate of 1,500, and a low resolution, you see that people want to have sensitivity rather than spectral resolution. Right? You see that with the advent of Pioneer, which is only low resolution, and way more sensitive, therefore, there's way more proposals.
Yeah, that was
way more successful, because it allows you to do surveys, it allows you to do time resolution, right? Things that are very difficult to do with Amber at high resolution, high spectral resolution. Nonetheless, I think the high spectral resolution mode of Amber with 12,000 gives you so much information on individual sources but you just do not have enough photons for a lot of interesting sources. So from for optical interferometry point of view, it's I think what you see, what the community tells us, is sensitivity.
Yeah.
People want sensitivity. And that is also reflected by gravity, right? For the first time, you can do now interferometry integrating for 100 seconds. Mm-hmm. Right, with Amber and fringe tracker like Finito, you could integrate maybe for 2 or 3 seconds at most, at very good conditions, because otherwise your fringes would be gone. But now you can do 100 seconds. It's again sensitivity.
Okay.
And from the optical interferometry point of view.
And you want to comment?
From the other end of that, one thing that's not listed on there is field of view. And of course, that's important for survey speed if you're doing large surveys of spectra or photometry or variability or anything like that. So that's important as well.
And do you think that photometry is still useful for us? I mean, people from the planetary field are really using a lot of photometry, but for stellar physics, do you think that it's still useful or not?
It can be. It depends on what you want to do with it. I mean, if you want to look, for example, I'm looking at low metallicity objects, so you need to go to nearby dwarf galaxies and things like that. There you need the sensitivity, but you also need the field of view in order to make that survey speed work.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to do, you can use photometry for variability, of course, as well. I mean, we've seen Tim's talk on mm-hmm. Monday, and it's showing how important variability can be in these situations.
Yeah.
I might be a little bit biased, but I think in the long wavelengths, we are having a lot of instruments being developed or being ready there for use. But when we are dealing with stellar winds, the UV is important, especially for hot stars. So we are losing UV capability soon, and there is no really nothing planned soon. So I think we, as a community, pushing for a UV capability can be interesting, at least, or important for us.
Okay. Since we are more or less running out of time, I will just want to say a few words about a future instrument. I have listed some of them, and just want to have your impression about that. So do you care about GWFT? I think the answer is yes, no? About Matisse, ELT, I don't know. Nobody has talked about, try to do the kind of study we are doing in the galaxy, in other galaxies, or do you think this is something that we should try to focus on? Or on there were talk about SKA for stellar winds. Do you think are you involved in this new project, or just to have your impression or to know? Someone want to say something? Yeah.
I mean, all the interferometric works that have been done by the interferometric communities are super interesting, but are all concerning the VLTI are all in our galaxy. So actually, will be very interesting to expand it to LMC or, but. Yeah, you would need a sensitivity, and that is not reachable now. So, I mean, I don't have.
Yes, it will be. I mean, with Matisse.
So my question actually was, until where we could observe.
I think with the second generation instrument, we can reach extragalactic targets. Huh? Willem, maybe you can comment on that, but I don't know the limited magnitude for gravity.
Regular fringe tracking on KS9 source,
mm-hmm.
Science source KS13 or 14, but I think they want to go up to, I don't dare saying it, 17 or so.
Okay, but you don't have to go to 20, I mean, for massive stars, for instance, or there is some targets that we can maybe observe.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, with I mean, the current limiting magnitudes are such that for many groups of stellar physics mm-hmm. and extragalactical for AGN, it's just at the border.
Yeah.
I mean, in my field, in Herbig AB stars, for example, you can do a couple, but you can't do all, right? You, you can't do really a good statistics. For the AGNs, you can do a couple, but you can't really do statistics of it with the current limiting magnitudes. But with gravity, these limiting magnitudes will go up, and it will be way easier to do clear statistical sampling of large groups of types of objects.
Jorik, you want to comment?
Well, there's one issue is sensitivity. The other issue, of course, is resolution. I mean, a lot of the interesting stellar physics happens close to the photosphere. And already now, for galactic stars, we have problems doing that with interferometry or direct imaging. But with, if we can combine it with polarization, especially on an ELT, where you have a 40-meter telescope, then for the first time in history, you can get spectral a signal-to-noise ratio in your polarized spectrum that is comparable to the spectroscopy that people have been doing for 100 years now. So you can then look at geometries, not just in our own galaxy, but in all kinds of extragalactic environments. So I think that would be a very nice complement to interferometry.
Yeah.
I mean, since you, in addition to that, and since you mentioned where will we arrive with the third generation of the interferometers?
I have prepared some slides, but we have no time. But I want to talk about the third generation of interferometer. Yes, we are, for instance, pushing and try to test a new instrument in the visible for making images with six telescopes. So this is something that we already have tested on Shara array. So we've 1 meter telescopes, but definitely yes, we have a project on that, and with adaptive optics on Shara, we can reach up to 10 magnitudes, so we will have access to milliarc second resolutions images with spectral resolution up to, let's say, 20,000. So this is something that we are currently pushing. Of course, it would be possible, I guess. It would depend on the success of Matisse and Gravity, I think. But otherwise, it would be hard to push further interferometry at the VLTI, at least. Okay, I think it's time. Pierre, we have to stop. So I want to thank you, everybody, for the discussion. Thank you.